Hi, everyone. It's The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. It's good to have you with us. We begin today on the steps of the Library of Congress, where 49-year-old Floyd Ray Roseberry of Grover, North Carolina, parked a black pickup truck for several hours on Thursday afternoon. During those hours, Mr. Roseberry posted several social media videos. And we've made an editorial decision here at The Takeaway not to play any portion of those recordings for you. Roseberry directly addressed President Biden, referring to him as Joe, while also indicating that the black pickup held explosive devices. Roseberry further indicated that he was part of a network of other individuals prepared to detonate explosive devices in other parts of the city. Just after 2 p.m. Eastern Time, Mr. Roseberry was taken into custody without incident. During the press conference immediately following the arrest, Capitol Police Chief Tom Manger was asked whether he was aware of Mr. Roseberry's motive.
We do know that Mr. Roseberry has had some losses of family in his, I believe his mother recently passed away. And we spoke with members of his family, and there were other issues that he was dealing with. There'll be more on that at a later time.
Now, this response is noteworthy because it suggests an individual mental illness framework for understanding Mr. Roseberry's actions. Actions which caused the evacuation of multiple federal buildings and revived fears stemming from the January 6th riot at the Capitol. During the standoff, Congressman Jamal Bowman of New York tweeted, quote, "My congressional team is safe and at home. These attacks are too familiar as we still heal from January 6th. Hope all workers on the ground arrive home safely soon." While Mr. Roseberry may well be suffering from grief, loss, or even diagnosed mental illness, describing these conditions as a motive for violent posturing is troublesome. This framework inaccurately stigmatizes mental illness by implying a link to violence. This is a myth. Those suffering with mental illness are not more likely to be violent. In fact, those with mental illness are far more likely to be the victims of crimes than to be violent perpetrators. And this framework obscures the pressing social, political, and public safety question. Was this incident linked to the rising tide of domestic terrorism in the United States, and particularly to the increase in white supremacist violence documented by multiple organizations and the Department of Homeland Security? Here to discuss Thursday's events at the Library of Congress and the interpretive frame used for understanding those events are Nicholas Wu, congressional reporter for Politico. Welcome, Nicholas.
Hi there.
And Leisha Brooks, chief of staff for the Southern Poverty Law Center. Welcome back to the show, Leisha.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
So, Nicholas, just get us up to date. What has happened since Mr. Roseberry was taken into custody on Thursday afternoon?
Well, since he was taken into custody, the Capitol Police gave the all clear. And so far as we know right now, it seems that there were no other bombs around the city and there was no actual bomb in his car. So this bomb threat that he had called in was just that, a threat, thankfully. Capitol staff are slowly returning to work in the buildings.
I was going to ask if that all clear meant that sort of on Friday morning that folks were able to have a normal work day.
As normal as things are right now, absolutely.
Now, Nicholas, the chief for the Capitol Police during the press conference said that he had already spoken with the suspect's family. I was surprised to hear that, but maybe that's normal procedure. Do you have a sense of that?
I think it's pretty normal procedure for during these kinds of negotiations for the authorities to reach out to the families. I mean, you saw that news organizations reached out to the family of Roseberry as well. And so I think the idea is just to get a better picture of what kind of person they're dealing with, how serious the threat could be, and where the person's really coming from as they try to negotiate and talk the suspect down.
Okay, so that's helpful. Leisha, I want to come to you on this because, I am hearing there from Nicholas that this is part of sort of the process. You know, you're faced with this standoff. You got to try to get through it. But I was surprised to hear the chief actually evoke this kind of individual's experiences of loss and grief as a potential motive for Thursday's events. Was that at all? What was kind of your reaction to that?
Thank you for the question. My reaction was similar to yours in the setup and your introduction. It's interesting that repeatedly, we see this happen repeatedly with white male suspects in engaged in acts of domestic terrorism, offered a different frame for their actions. It's also interesting that the chief seemed at a loss to identify the motive for his actions when I think Mr. Roseberry clearly stated what his motives were. He repeatedly evoked images of the Confederacy, talking about the Rising South, calling it a revolution, and his directing his words directly to President Joe Biden, I think was really, really clear. So in all that he said and all that he did over those hours, it's quite interesting to me that the chief would land where he did.
So again, I don't want to give the chief individually too hard a time for this. I'm sure, you know, I'm sure that in these moments it's quite tense. But I will say that, like you, I was surprised at the idea that there wouldn't be a mention of politics, of race, of, you know, the sort of Southern identity aspects, because it was Mr. Roseberry himself who said all of those things. We're not imputing that.
Southern Poverty Law Center, you know, for years we've watched people who have been radicalized into the anti-government movement take, you know, these violent actions. And so we're not at all surprised that, you know, Mr. Roseberry, like other, you know, anti-government extremists, have personal issues related to their health or finances. And what is interesting is that these extremists often craft plots to seek justice or revenge against the government. And the Southern Poverty Law Center's research shows that this typically occurs more frequently after a Democratic president is elected.
So, Nicholas, I'm wondering, as you know, as a congressional reporter, as someone who is, you know, obviously sort of knows what's happening in the post January 6th moment that Capitol Hill is living in, sort of initially, if you were hearing from folks about either their sense of fear or and as I will say this word, their sense of terror about what was unfolding.
Yeah, I mean, Capitol Hill is very much on edge after what happened on January 6th and, you know, after what happened in March, too, when there was a car attack on the Capitol. But it's always kind of a tricky situation because the Capitol is a very high profile place. You have these kind of suspicious incident reports phoned in all the time. And often it's nothing very serious. Someone just left like a backpack unattended and the like. But, you know, every now and then it does escalate to something more serious. And that was the real fear that you saw among staffers yesterday. Like, was this going to be, you know, just a suspicious vehicle that was, you know, parked in the wrong spot? Or was this something much more serious? And you know, as we learned more throughout Thursday morning, we really started to grasp how potentially severe of a situation this was.
Okay, so building on this, Nicholas, Leisha, I want to come to you, but I want to play something for you. It's a little bit long, but I think it might be informative here. Back on July 30th, I had a wide-ranging conversation with former Capitol Police Chief Terry Gaynor, and I asked him about the 2014 incident when Capitol Police shot and killed Miriam Carey, who was an African-American woman whose infant child was strapped in a car seat in the car. And I want to play what Chief Gaynor said to me.
We did and do have different procedures when we believe a car is a improvised explosive device vehicle, the way to deliver that. So unlike police departments across the United States that have pretty much stopped saying you do not shoot at moving vehicles for any reason, even if the vehicle is coming at the officer, we don't shoot. But on the Capitol complex and other areas, if there's a thought that you are going to deliver a bomb, you are authorized to use force likely to cause death. I know some of the blowback on that, and frankly, I think there should have been much more transparency, and people should see that now.
So, Leisha, I want to be really clear. I applaud the Capitol Police for not escalating this and making it a violent circumstance. But I got to say, between having just talked to former Chief Gaynor about the authorization to use that kind of force, hearing from Nicholas about how on edge the Capitol is right now. And then I just can never get Miriam Carey, a woman who was unarmed, African-American woman who just had a baby, was shot dead. And this gentleman was rightly allowed to sort of gather more information.
No, I too applaud the actions of the Capitol Police. They were protecting public safety. And it could have been because Roseberry told them that if they were to shoot into the vehicle, that there would be another explosion. So I want to give them that. But the point that you raised with respect to kind of how people are treated differently in their engagements with law enforcement is just a fact. Regardless of policies or procedures, we see this time and time again, how individuals based on racial demographics for sure are treated differently. And you had to know that Roseberry, I just have to mention this, because as you said, I mean, he's painted the way we're painting him now, we're losing the fact that this person was radicalized. And we know that thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of American citizens have been radicalized over the last several years. Mr. Roseberry belonged to Facebook groups like White Lives Matter. He also liked hate groups like FAIR and Numbers USA, which are anti-immigrant. And the beliefs that they propagate were referenced in his own words, as you said. So we also have to remember he had a YouTube account where he said, you know, if Trump speaks, you listen. The fact of the matter is that once again, I think that we can lay this on at the feet of the former president, because this is directly connected to the insurrection and of January 6th. It's just another more evidence of increased radicalization across the country.
I just so that I get a yes or no on this, is it possible for someone to both be suffering from a mental illness and to be radicalized by white supremacist hate groups?
Of course, they're certainly more susceptible. Yes.
Leisha Brooks is Chief of Staff for the Southern Poverty Law Center, and Nicholas Wu is Congressional Reporter for Politico. Thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thanks.